And David made him houses in the city of David, and prepared a place for the ark of God, and pitched a tent. Then David said, None ought to carry the ark of God but the Levites, for them hath the Lord chosen to carry the ark of God, and to minister unto him forever. Welcome back to Bookwave, the Book Club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Pat.
Hey, yeah.
And Jason.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
And today, we're looking at the book of 1 Chronicles in the Bible of our series, The Holy Bible Book Club. And the first question I have to the both of you and to anybody listening at home is, when we're reading more and more about the Ark of the Covenant and David and eventually going back to Genesis here, what do you think about the Ark of the Covenant, and do you think it could be considered an idol by some of the other religious folks in the area, in the same way that the Israelites consider these statues of Baals to be heretical idols or something like that? So what do you guys think?
That is indeed a good question, though. Never really thought of it that way. Well, for the most part, the idols that we've learned about in the previous books were in the shapes of different animals or of different people. But the ark is sort of like just an object, kind of like a piece of furniture and everything. But it does have specific types of powers, and it is, in a way, a weapon of mass destruction for anyone who touches it or tries to open it and everything like that. So it's kind of hard to say. So I would have to say no, because, you know, it's just, in my reading of it, it's just an object, a very sacred object. And it's sort of like a reminder of God giving a piece of himself to his people. And the rest of the Israelites just carrying it with them throughout their journey. Even serving it as a reminder of where they came from and where they are now.
So in a way, if this is a piece of God, is this kind of like a supposed to be what Jesus comes to represent as part of God? You know, God gives Jesus to the world. So is the ark kind of a representation of that before we get to the New Testament?
I think we're getting into the weeds here of like the Trinity, and the like Jesus is supposed to be fully man and fully God. And I don't know. Talking about him like he's kind of like a gift from God might insinuate that he's not himself God. So I don't know how to really go about those little mind loops.
Sure. And I wasn't 100% sure exactly what I was trying to say, but I have a little bit of a different take or perspective than Pat on it. I kind of saw the Ark of a Covenant as an idol, in the same way that if you look at the Game of Thrones, you have the Throne of Swords is kind of an idol. And so that's how I see the ark, that it's supposedly this throne for God to sit on in the earthly realm. But I don't see it as an idol like the statues of Dagon and Baal are.
That's interesting, comparing it to the Iron Throne. There might be something to that. That might be what George was actually trying to say when he wrote those books. Because I didn't really think of the Ark of the Covenant as a part of God, but more like something that they built for God. Because they talk about like the seat at the top and then the two cherubim perched on it. And It's different in that way from the idols. Like, it's not a representation of God. It's like a throne for God. It's something to hold up to say, hey, this is where you're allowed to sit. Not like a, this is just a representation of you, that we worship the idol, and in turn we're worshiping God, like say the Canaanites might have been doing.
Right. And if you're on the side of the God sitting on this Ark of the Covenant, it's going to represent that you're on the winning team through the various acts of war that's been committed underneath this banner.
Yeah, almost like they tried to transcend the idea of an idol. Like, you put too much value in your little statues of your God. You're losing appreciation for the actual God that you worship. And we're not gonna, bastardize that image by creating something to represent our God. We're just going to create a seat for him to sit on. We don't need to represent him because he represents himself. He's everywhere already. So yeah. I think that gave me a little bit of extra perspective.
Yeah, and for that quote that we opened up on, seeing as how David is now fully grown and his family is expanding and his kingdom is expanding, he's no longer trying to do this for personal gain, as far as I can tell. He's more like trying to understand that this is something very important, like important in a sense that I can no like he can no longer think of himself as just a powerful king and he can get whatever he wants to. This is something that he cannot take for granted. This is probably one of the most important job titles that he can hold, essentially.
And you see him like setting up the hierarchy too with the Levites, 'cause he says no one can carry around, not just anybody can carry around the Ark of the Covenant. It's the job of the Levites. And there was one thing in when I was reading through the Asimov's Guide to the Bible, where he was talking about how the Levites are really favored in this version of the story. Like, when you're reading through the books of Moses, it doesn't, or the books after Moses, it doesn't really put much like a value on the Levites themselves in those books. But when you're looking at the recap version of it in Chronicles, it presents the Levites as the like elites of the Israelites, like the top political faction. So I wonder what's going on there a little, because we know there's like two different traditions at least that spawned like the different recounts of the stories that we have here. So I just, it makes me wonder what was the role of the Levites during this whole time period that we're describing here.
Well, weren't they the priestly people? And so, I mean, they were kind of a certain class of society. Priests were quite high up, and so it was a privilege,
Yeah,
an honor.
and one of the documents that we have, that we get the whole of the Bible from, is known to us as the P document, which is short for the priestly document, which was written by the Levites. So I think Chronicles, like when we're reading through Chronicles, we're reading through the story that was actually written by the Levites. And I suspect that they're trying to give themselves a little bit more notoriety than they deserved. Like, they wanted to make it look like they were more important in history than they actually were. Or to make a point that once they stopped adhering to the laws of the Levites and the Ark of the Covenant, that's when things started going downhill and started getting squirrely. And they just wanted to get that message across.
Well, it might be I think it's interesting to note that this book, First Chronicles, and the one following it, were written somewhere like 300 to 400 years after the Babylonian exile that we saw in Second Kings, I believe, was the last book we read.
Sounds about right, yeah. And there are parts in this book too, in Chronicles, where it describes the, you know, all of the books of the law getting taken away, so they don't like have anything anymore, and they just kind of have to refill in all the blanks. So it could just be like they have their oral traditions and they have the stuff that was written down, and you know, game of broken telephone, we know how long it takes for one story to change. And just on that note, there was another thing that Asimov talked a lot about, was Goliath. You see, in all of our English translations of the Bible, they took out, like, they edited it. In the original script, it says that they give the credit of killing Goliath to someone else, not David. So it's like, they changed it in the Book of Chronicles to say that he killed the brother of Goliath, not Goliath himself. So I don't know. It's hard for me to trust the straight up word of this when I do a little bit of research and it's like, nope, the original says they just killed Goliath. So if you're just reading the story of David and then you read Chronicles, like in the original story, the original tradition, it was Goliath both times, not just the brother of Goliath dying to this other random hero who doesn't pop up again in the Bible. It's just like those like little stories that get recycled sometimes, and then eventually down the line, no one remembers the original name, and they just say, well, this is a good story, let me just insert the name David and, you know, keep the story around, keep the tradition alive, and just keep going. But that also puts together a lot more when you look at, like, when David meets Saul twice. Well, one of those is obviously wrong. So, like, the mythical story of David versus Goliath, in my opinion, is written way long after and was just inserted to say, hey, this is a story someone came up with afterwards. They wrote a little fan fiction. We'll include that in scripture because we like it so much. That's my theory.
And of course they bring up the giants again in chapter 20. So it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah, that's
what's going on there.
That's where it talks about like the death of Goliath's brother or the death of Goliath, depending on how you read it. But you know, I might be as wrong as I can get, so don't take my word for it.
And again, just to reiterate to our listeners, this is our first time going through the Bible, and we're still trying to understand it. We're not experts or anything like that. We're just three guys on the internet, just developing a book club and just coming together once a week to give our own understandings of what we're reading.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I'm an atheist reading the Bible as if it's a novel. So, you know, take that as you will. If that's useful for you, if that's fun for you, then join us on this adventure. But if you're only interested in the Bible as the Word of God, I don't think that's what you're going to find on this channel.
You may have a hard time dealing with us.
And we're sorry, but not sorry at the same time. So what else in this book really stuck out to you guys? Jason, I know you had some stuff you wanted to get into.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is another one of the books where it starts with chronicling all of the the male and important descendants going back to Adam. And I mean, the first word in the book is Adam, followed by a period, and then listing, Seth and all of his descendants. And I know we haven't really talked about, I guess, the Garden of Eden, probably since our first discussion on Genesis. And I guess one of my biggest arguments that I am not a Christian is this setup, essentially, in the Garden of Eden, where God forms us in his supposed image, but then tells us, there's this one fruit, the fruit of knowledge of good versus evil, that's planted in the middle of the garden. And basically, in my perspective, it's a setup, because if God is omnipotent, he should realize that humans are gonna be interested in that fruit. And to punish all of humanity for that one transgression, what the church calls original sin, I feel it's, harsh, unfair. And so that's why I've always had trouble getting on board with this religion, where that's one of the central tenets of original sin.
Yeah, it kind of reads almost like God is setting up some social experiment. Like, I'm going to create humans. I'm going to give them complete autonomy and free will. And then I'm going to punish them for using the gifts that I've given them. But then there's like the other thing that we have to talk about, which is extra prevalent in the Book of Chronicles, which is the Satan retcon. Because when you're reading Genesis, it's a serpent that tempts Eve into eating the apple, and then Eve tempts Adam into eating the apple, and then Adam blames Eve for making him eat the apple. So God says, "You're all a mess. You're out of my garden forever now." But then, when the Christians decide that that snake is actually Satan, or when the Israelites decide that when God asked them to count everybody in Israel, and then they counted everybody in Israel, they say that was Satan instead. So I think it's just a little bit too convenient of a trick to put in. Like, I don't think originally when they wrote it, the Satan figure had any prevalence at all in the story of like Genesis or anything like that. I really think it's just supposed to represent how things are. And if you look at God as, like, for lack of a better word, the universe, which doesn't really have any will of its own or desires of its own, it just exists and just is. And then you look at the humans as just being created by the universe, by just forming, by sheer nature of what makes us, what makes the stars, the great mystery, and whatever. I think it kind of makes more sense that, like, yeah, the universe created us, the universe set up obstacles for us, we stumbled through a lot of those obstacles, we've made our mistakes. Going forward, we have to deal with it. And I think the real problem came when we started assigning agency to the universe. Because, like, I think that's just how humans have their own problems. It's like, we assign agency to, a rock if we really have the mind to. We assign agency to, like, our car. Like, if you have a 10-year-old car and it's barely still putting along, and you make it from point A to point V for the billionth time, you say, "Good job, buddy, we made it." You're assigning agency to something that effectively doesn't have any agency. If you're like a gambler and you roll some dice, you're gonna treat those dice as if they're alive for that little brief moment. So I think, I don't know, I think the evolution of religion has coincided with our need as people to assign agency to non-living things, inanimate objects, or even dead people. Like when we say they're, when somebody dies, we say, "Oh, they're still here. They're still around. They're with us. You know, they're watching us." You know, it's the kind of language we use just so we don't feel alone, sort of.
Right, and those are really good points. And one of the questions I have, though, trying to adopt the a biblical perspective on it, is what was the goal? What was the original goal of God in this quote unquote social experiment? You know,
Yeah,
like
but
what?
in my view, like if you're Christian, I'm wrong. But in my view, God doesn't have a will, or like he's not trying to do anything. He's not trying to prove anything. He's just creating something because that's what it or he or she or they does. Like
Do you think
when.
that they were just bored and wanted some kind of body to observe and, you know,
I think it's because it helped them, because it was, I mean, it's like for the same reason that like I described earlier, like you want some kind of edge. So, you know, you whisper to your dice, you say, "Come on, no snake eyes, no snake eyes." And then you throw them. You talk to your car because you want your car to get you from point A to point B. You know, rationally, that's not going to work, but up here, it's useful in your noggin, in that big melon of yours. It helps you cope, knowing that you can talk to this car, you can whisper to your dice. I don't know if that's like the exact same kind of thing that happened, but I think that says a lot about what we are as people. That we have that need, and that originally religion kind of grew out of that need. I think a lot of it is like we don't want to be alone. We don't want to have like fear of the unknown. We want to be able to categorize things. And if we say like everything around us is chaos and completely. Like, we don't know anything about it. There's dragons, there's giants, there's 10,000 feet serpents swimming around the oceans. Like, we don't know. It creates a lot more sound environment when you say it was all created by God. You know, at least we can put it into that category. It was all created by God, right? We can agree on that. And everyone in the village says, "Yeah, we can agree on that." So, and when everybody agrees on that, that's the unification right there. That's the useful fiction, the unifying story that everyone else can rally behind and say, "Yeah, this, we can all categorize and label the chaotic things with our labels." And that's magic right there. If you can take something that terrifies you and just speak a word, and all of a sudden it is just something that you're familiar with, that is created by God, that you know exactly where it came from. I don't see how that wouldn't help you mentally.
And this creation story goes one step further to to say that, you know, not only are you part of this creation, but you as a man, as a woman, as mankind are going to rule over and have dominion over everything.
Yeah, and that's another thing too, like when you look at what makes a human, one of the things that always comes up is like we communicate with strangers every day. No, nothing else in the animal kingdom does that. Like you look at an ant colony, they're all unified by the queen. They're not really strangers. They're just kind of clones of each other. But humans, we come from all over the planet, and we're able to just interact with a stranger. We go to walk into any store, and we know they're going to treat us with dignity and respect. And I think that comes from early religion saying that, like, all humans are connected. We rally together. We're stronger together. Together, we're much more than the sum of our parts. And yeah, at that point, it just started getting more and more, like people started getting more and more comfortable meeting people that they have never met before, because they had this story that, you know, all of the humans were descended from Adam. First word, first Chronicles. It all starts with Adam. So if we can agree that it all starts with Adam and Eve, then we can agree that we're all brothers and sisters. And if we're all brothers and sisters, then, you know, there's no reason to not greet a stranger like they're related, you know? And it's just kind of, I'm not saying that, you know, because of Christianity, humans are able to talk to strangers. I'm saying, like, because of these early inclinations of early religion, we're able to see all humans as connected, because we all have these stories that say we're connected. And the Genesis story is the biggest of those stories for our culture, so.
Yeah, I think one of the more tragic things about this story, unfortunately, is that with Adam and Eve being cast out of the Garden of Eden, you know, they're considered flawed. And so all of their descendants, in a way, have this original sin attached to them. And it's not until the time of, I believe, Noah, that God just wipes out everybody and everything starts over again with Noah's family. So
Yeah.
you could say that we all started from Adam and Eve based on the timeline, or you could also say we started from Noah because allegedly they were the only family that survived.
Yeah, wasn't there like still giants in the land after Noah's flood? I guess we
Well,
wouldn't be connected to them, though.
then the giants come back later, as we've seen with David.
Yeah. There's another thing in Genesis too, where it's like after Cain kills his brother Abel, they're presented as the first humans. Then Cain just shuffles off to the next village over and joins their people and finds a wife. So where did they come from? That's almost evidence that we didn't start from Adam. But in the broader sense of Genesis, you could always say that we all started from God or the universe or whatever terminology you use to describe
Could
such a thing.
it be that there was like a village of angels or something that Cain went to live with, and that's where he like started, I guess, reproducing with them to create the Nephilim?
Yeah, I guess the angels wouldn't have survived the flood, or the giants, sorry, wouldn't have survived the flood. They just would have come back again. Like more angels fell and created more giants. But then you have to wonder, what's an angel? What's an angel really? Because, like, we don't really have the faintest idea.
According to some artists, they can be quite scary, like the seraphim.
Yeah, like the wheels and the eyes and everything. Yeah. I've seen
Yeah, there's
some.
one that's not even a body. It's just like he said, some wheels.
Yeah. I've seen some artist renderings of angels that look pretty terrifying. Remind me of some H.P. Lovecraft type stuff.
Now, it was after the flood that the Tower of Babel was being constructed, correct?
Yeah.
All right. So I was thinking about this, and could the Tower of Babel have been some kind of insurance or protection against another flood? They're worried that this omnipotent being is going to, flood the earth, so they attempt to build a very large tower to save themselves.
Yeah, and if you're at the top of the tower, the water's not going to reach you, so that makes a lot of sense. I mean, in Genesis itself, it just presents it like, oh, they're trying to get closer to God. But when you say it like that kind of puts some pieces together.
Yeah, so Nimrod, the builder of the tower, he was an ancestor of Ham, which
Yeah.
was one of Noah's sons.
Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Three Noah's kids. So yeah, then if Nimrod knew about the flood, which of course he did, everybody knew about the flood, then why wouldn't you try to create something to prevent another thing?
Exactly. And this is what Yahweh saw as being evil. He said, you are usurping my power. If I want to kill you guys, I'm going to drown you, 100 feet of water. How dare you try to build a tower?
Huh.
I kind of feel that Nimrod, in a way, despised God. He was wanting he doesn't want a lord that is going to act like an S&M master over him.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, like, the motivations of Nimrod could be, haha, God, you won't get me. I'll show you. I'll make a tower. You won't flood me. And God just sees that as a direct challenge and says, you know what? None of you can understand each other anymore. Good luck building a tower now. Like, punishing humans that he created for preparing for the future, for the act of self-preservation. There must be something to that too. Like, are we supposed to not care about the future? Are we supposed to just live in the day and
Well, in a
not build
way,
shelters or houses or towers and just isolate ourselves? Is that what God is trying to tell us?
God is pretty much telling his people, if you do this, you will reach the future. As long as you do that, then you'll be able to make it. But of course, they have their own perspectives, kind of like the Tower of Babel, where after the collapse of the Tower of Babel, where their languages got mixed and they were different and everything, their perspectives were also clouded with judgment, and also they saw different things that maybe God did not even realize at the time. Or to go back to what you were saying, Scott, maybe it was an experiment to see what they were thinking at the time. But again, we don't know if that was the case, but yeah, that's essentially what God was pretty much telling his people. If you do this for me, I will give you a future, a bright and better future for yourself.
You're talking about the original covenant with Abraham.
What do you mean? Like,
Well, God's saying to Abraham, you are going to go into this land And I'm going to create descendants for you that will outnumber the stars. But in order, before that happened, I mean, from my perspective, God kind of makes himself out to be this undesirable character when he's telling Abraham, you know, I want you to sacrifice your son. And I mean, I don't know. I haven't been able to justify like a being that would ask a human to do that.
Yeah, I think the problem is you're thinking of it as a being. You're putting too many limitations on this thing we call God. But yeah, the Tower of Babel happens before Abraham's journey starts. So, like, the way I kind of read it in Genesis was like when the Tower of Babel fell, that's where Abraham's family kind of was. And then he was one of the guys that wandered off to the west towards Israel. And then, you know, all of those events started happening, and the covenant, and then his children, and then the selling of the little brother into Egypt. And all that stuff. Like, if you read it like it's like a little 12-year-old playing Sims, telling his like little created characters where to go and what to do, I'm sure it can be pretty insulting to, you know, anybody's intelligence and say, like, well, what God would do that? He's. But if you look at it like, God himself or itself doesn't have any real agency. It's just what is. And yeah, that's the only way I can really read the Bible or like read about the topic of God, because like I don't think that it's possible for an agent outside of time and space to be controlling everything that happens in the world, but also doesn't have any control over human will. Like, you can't have it both ways. We can't all be free agents and all be living out God's plan. So, like, when I hear the words God's plan, it's just, oh no, that's just the determined future. Like, there are a million possible futures, like a million squared possible futures, but only one of them are going to happen. So that one possible future is the determined future, whether we like it or not. God, as the existence of the universe, is going down that path, is going down that line, and it all kind of fits together. But I don't think he's telling us all what to do. I think we're all in complete control of ourselves, and we're just interacting, different nodes in a network, all firing off together. God is the network. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but so if God isn't telling us what to do, how do we get into the issue of, well, the devil made me do it?
I don't know, man. The devil doesn't make any sense to me. It's just like to me, the devil and Satan and demons are just like natural obstacles. Like, if you're facing a demon, it's because like you're an alcoholic trying not to have another drink. That's a demon. If you're facing Satan, then it's the adversary. You're going head to head against someone, like ideology versus ideology, left versus right, you know, that's the adversary. You're up against the Satan. Or like, I don't know. They're just like words to describe life that got turned into agents, 'cause as humans, we can't help but assign agents to aspects of nature, like war. We needed to give it a god of war or a horseman to represent war. We can't just have like an abstract concept of war. We need to have some kind of figure that we can visualize to say, like, oh, that invokes the image of Ares, the god of war, or the pale horse with a rider dressed in black. We need symbology because symbology is a part of our heads, and we just started forgetting how to reverse that translation.
It kind of reminds me of what John Vervaeke talks about in his lecture series on awakening from the meaning crisis, which is we, and I'm just paraphrasing what he mentioned in a lecture, but he talks about language and the concept of mythology and storytelling, and we are so attracted to it that we end up being inspired by it to come up with names that we don't even know existed, or we've just come to see them for the first time. So, we don't know what something is or what someone is, so we just come up with a name, even though that name in particular has already been used thousands and thousands of years ago. We just happen to pick that up and just use that. And kind of the same way, I kind of see a similar pattern with the lineages of David, the with everything, with the names and how they've grown and how they address the temple and make the sacrifices until eventually David dies.
Well, speaking of putting a name or an agent behind something, the author of this, the chronicler, they name, is it the adversary or do they name Satan when they're talking about who ordered that census that David undertook? And it's almost like they did that because, well, when we were reading this, I believe it was in Samuel, where David's ordered to take a census by God, and he goes out and does it, but then gets in trouble for doing it. It's almost like the chronicler didn't want us to think about God in an unfair light, and so they name
It's
the
like
agent.
going It's like going back to the mindset of God is a 12-year-old playing The Sims, which I refuse.
Yeah, David was tempted in 21, chapter 21.
I think the reasoning for the two differences in this story stems from a misunderstanding of the original text. Because, like, if you just read God as, the universe constructing on its own, you don't have anyone to blame. But as soon as you look at it in the way where, there's a good guy God and a bad guy God, oh, now you have someone to blame. And that whole mindset came from the Zoroastrians, who came in a little bit before the Book of Chronicles was written. So when the Zoroastrians came in, their religion was like just based on that. There were two gods in this in eternal struggle over the fate of humanity. One was a force of good, and the other was a force of evil and corruption, and they're just in constant battle with one another. And they just took a bunch of that mythology and blended it with their own mythology, and they came up with Satan. So I don't know. I think all religions are equally useful and also equally like fabricated. So I don't really see a problem with it too much because it's all just useful fiction. But at the same time, it's like these people's religion that they value so much, like their way of life, their tradition, everything that they value just gets flipped over. And then they keep everything from before and try to interpret everything before that through this new lens of, oh, there's a God and a Satan, not just a one God that created everything. And then they try to blend the two by saying, oh, there is the one God that created everything. Yeah, that's still a thing. But one of those things was the Satan, and now he's the adversary to God, which, I don't know, there's a bunch of holes in that. Like if Satan was created by God and he's just a fallen angel, then why in so many cases is he presented as an equal? Well, it's because of the Zoroastrian tradition that just got lumped in.
Yeah, it's a giant rabbit hole.
Yeah. Like researching all this stuff is a lot of fun, but it's really complicated and convoluted at the same time. And I also don't know how offensive I am. Like, I'm just trying to be honest. So, like, if you're a Christian and you're listening to me rant and babble about, what Christianity and Judaism means, then, like, you can disregard me if you want.
Yeah, and again, we're just trying to understand this book. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and like Paul Vanderclay, like he called us a bunch of virgins in a whorehouse when it comes to the Bible. So like, yeah, we really don't have a frame of reference for this. So we don't go to church. We're not surrounded by religious people telling us what ideas are heretical and which ideas aren't. Like, I know I listened to some videos online about people like debating the idea of the Trinity, and it's like neither of your arguments make sense to me because I just don't have anything that has come after the Bible to say, like, oh, this is what Christianity means. I'm just looking at the oldest possible source material for your religion doesn't really give me anything to do with Christianity because it all keeps compounding upon itself and it keeps going folding over and folding over and folding over. And like today's Christians and Jews are unrecognizable from the people that we see in the Bible here, so.
Yeah, and plus back then it was just a completely different concept. It was incomplete. I do get a chuckle when Paul mentions that we're virgins reading the Bible, you know?
Yeah.
That's actually a really good. Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that conversation with Paul Vanderclay definitely helped my understanding going forward anyway. It's equipped me with a couple more tools. And another thing I wanted to bring up was like just since we're talking about Paul Vanderclay and he recommended to us that we read The Lord of the Rings, so we've started that. And I heard him say once that, if you're looking for, if you're Frodo and you're looking for God, who is God in that situation? Well, it's Tolkien. So if you're looking for Tolkien as Frodo, where do you find Tolkien? You'd find him in Samwise. You'd find him in Gandalf. You'd find him in Aragorn. You'd find him in Legolas. You'd find him in every single thing you encounter because Tolkien created your world. And I think that's an interesting worldview to put yourself in. And it's interesting to look at it in that perspective. Say like if
Yeah,
we're
we're
all
gonna. Yeah, we're currently reading The Fellowship of the Ring, and we'll begin discussing that sometime next week or so.
Yeah, really looking forward to getting into our Lord of the Rings conversations. We've already read The Hobbit, so if you've missed that one and you're interested, go find that one and check it out. And then go read The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings books after you're done with your Bible. Did we have anything else to cover pertaining specifically to First Chronicles or to recap? I mean, this is just, in a way, it's a recap and filler with like genealogies and everything. It's all the worst parts of an anime episode, so there's not really much to talk about, but did you have anything else?
I think we pretty much got the gist of it, jabbed at it.
Yeah, I didn't have too many notes for this one, so. Well, until next time, you can check us out at our website, www.bookwave.club. We're on YouTube, Stitcher, all the other good podcasts, Spotify, all the good podcast platforms. And like, comment, subscribe, share with all your friends and family. May the force be with you.
Later.
Go read a book.